producers of KFAR Radio or any of our respective employees, affiliates, or sponsors of this program.
Problems, problems, problems all day long. Will my problems work out right or wrong? My baby don't like anything I do. My teacher seems to feel the same way too.
Good morning, Fairbanks. You're listening to KFAR Radio. We're at 660 on the AM dial, 97.5 on the FM dial, and we live stream at KFARradio.com. This is Problem Corner. I'm your host, David Pruse. If you want to call into today's show, we're at 907-458-TALK. That's 907-458-8255. It's a Monday, and last Wednesday, we were supposed to have Nick Nugent. But I rescheduled him for a Monday because he's such a nice, fine, polite person. And the reschedule on Wednesday was supposed to be on Friday, but I got knocked out with an ailment, and we put on something else. I have no idea what it was. But, Nick, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, Dave. I'm actually pretty happy to see you here after what I saw on Friday.
Yeah, I so appreciate your ability to reconfigure your dates on the radio with me.
Not an awful lot in the summer going on. It's pretty easy to do.
Yeah. But, hey, you know, today's a good one. But, first of all, I'm sorry. Everything that you bring in is very good. But, you know, I grew up with a lot of miners.
Yes.
Miners' kids, rather. And the areas that their lineage mined, you know, I could never graphically realize where it was. And you're doing one at my request. And it's the mining districts of Ruby, Anoka, and the Iditarod area, you know, the flat area. And you know, I've never been out there. So start telling us about it, please.
Well, I think it's an interesting area, and you mentioned the reason why a number of miners from there ended up in Fairbanks, either wintered over or eventually moved here after they kind of got out of mining. And I think there's as much connection to that mining district in Fairbanks as there is any other mining district now.
Yeah.
You know, it lasted longer than some of the ones north of us. Well, so we're going to look at these three mining districts in the western interior. They're all three lie between the Yukon and Kuskokwim. The Iditarod is fairly well known for the race run along the trail of the same name. The others maybe aren't quite household names, except possibly to the descendants of the miners who toiled these areas. Numerous small camps and towns were located in the area. It was Iditarod, Discovery, Otter City, Flat, which I think we've pretty well all heard of, Ophir, which every time you listen to the northern route of the Iditarod, we'll pick up the name Ophir, Glen Gulch, Placerville, Poorman, Long, and Willow Creek. Ruby, Dykeman, Otter City, and Iditarod were the major transportation centers at the time. Loads were switched usually to smaller and smaller boats to travel on these very small rivers. The town Flat's pretty aptly named. There's not the world's supply of topography out there, and it tends to be pretty swampy. In the summer, there's very little chance for overland transportation, so it goes on the rivers. The Anoka had a whole fleet of little boats, all less than 100 feet long with very shallow draft. Some of those boats were actually built here in Fairbanks to go further up the Tanana and then went out to that way when the strike was made and there wasn't as much development up the Tanana as was thought.
Okay.
So compared to those on the Yukon, simplicity and lack of frills really stood out. They didn't want anything which created draft and pushed the boat deeper in the water. We'll also look at some of the miners, prospectors, and others who lived in the area. That's usually what makes an area interesting. Many of the names, such as the Miskovich family particularly, will be pretty that's going to be pretty familiar to any of our listeners in Fairbanks.
You know, my dad, this is what he said about the Miskoviches. My dad always, you know, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, always had bars. And he said, you know, when the Miscaviches came in for mining, it was nothing but a party for a week or two. Then they'd all leave and go to wherever they went for the winter. Then they'd come back about a week before or 2 weeks before they went out to the mines. And it was a wild party until they went out. And, you know, then they worked hard and, you know, shut their nightlife down and went out and, you know, did their gold mining and just hardworking family.
Well, we're going to talk about a couple of the Miscaviches as we get into today, but that might be a good subject in the future. They were a large family, mm-hmm. and when you really start reading, there were a lot of them that were very successful in different things. So another one of those folks that came to Alaska and added an awful lot to our early history. Well, several of the miners from Flat and these districts have been inducted into the Alaska Mining Hall of Fame. If you go to their website, just Google it, you can find all the induction biographies, and it's well worth reading. Spend some time on their website, and you won't be sad you did. Well, our locales then, if we set those, the Ruby Airport, Fairbanks International to Ruby is 233 miles west of Fairbanks.
Yeah, it's not northwest, it's west.
Yes.
I mean, it's just stick your left arm out, face north, and just follow your left arm.
You do, and it's. I think that's surprising sometimes.
Yeah.
The number of places that we think, oh, those must be north of us.
Yeah.
Well, Eagle and Nome are
east.
You can just
west.
About draw a line
yeah.
through the three places. Well, so that mining district extends south toward McGrath, which is, of course, on the Kuskokwim. The Iditarod and Innoko districts are about 75 miles further west, with Iditarod roughly 360 air miles from Fairbanks. The early USGS publications refer to distances in term of river miles. Those were the only and the mostly used corridors, and in the summer, almost the only. The mileage was what was faced by the early travelers, and it makes for some interesting comparison where the air distance from Iditarod to Dykeman is 29 miles, while the travel distance is closer to 70. So it took a long,
yeah.
A half-hour airplane flight was a day-and-a-half trip. Other distances were often measured from the village of Holy Cross. Holy Cross was directly across the Yukon from the mouth of the Innoko. It was a transshipment point, larger boats putting goods onto smaller. It's about 500 miles in length, and the lower 150 miles was often called Shagalak Slough. Due to extremely slow currents, and it also has a second mouth onto the Yukon, onto an actual slough of the Yukon. The drainage basin covers 500 square miles with a lot of prospects. In 1910, though, the area being mined and most productive was contained in an area about 10 miles square. Practically all productive ground was in the valley of Otter Creek, just south of Flat Creek. Well, the explorations of the Kuskokwim involving Americans likely started around 1889. Josiah Spur of the USGS, Lieutenant Heron with the Army, led expeditions in those days from Cook Inlet to the Kuskokwim drainage, then a little bit later, 1898-99. But placer gold was not discovered until 1906 on Gaines Creek along the Innoko. Word spread very slowly due to the isolation of the area. By 1908, there was an established camp with an average of 150 miners during the up-season. The settlement of Ophir at the mouth of Ophir Creek was established in the spring of 1908, and in the years 1908 through 1910, gold production was about $750,000. That amounted to 41,670 ounces.
So they were basically getting about $17 an ounce.
At that time, so.
What is it now? I better call up Jerry Clearworth and see what it is now, $4,700, $4,800 an ounce? That's a great appreciation rate.
It really is. And you look at now when you buy and sell gold, if you look at the trader's profit, is probably more than a lot of guys mined in a week.
Yeah.
Well, writing for the USGS in 1911, A.G. Madron noted that the Innoko suffered from chronic shortages of provisions and mining equipment. That and the high costs had led to very little follow-on exploration, and the expected deposits were not being found. In several areas, notably to the southwest of Ophir, fine colors could be found in many locations, though none in significant quantities to mine. It was very, very frustrating. You could find gold about anywhere. You could stick a shovel in the ground, but not in a quantity that would let you use it. Now, we back up a bit to the summer, late summer of 1908. W.A. Dykeman and John Beaton, veterans of the Klondike, and Beaton's brother Murdoch, traveled from the Innoko downstream to what became known as the Iditarod. It was just a branch of the Innoko at the time. One of the reasons you see so many rivers renamed, if you had a new river, mm-hmm. you could put a new claim on it.
Ah.
So that's particularly why in mining areas, every little thing with water in it is
got named. That's it. You know, I never knew that. Fairbanks, I want you to remember that. Why does it have a name? Because that way they could put a claim on it. Miners, what they did for the naming of us, like Friday Creek. How many Friday Creeks do we have?
Absolutely.
Because we came across this on a Friday.
And that was particularly when you discovered gold on a new creek, you got the two claims for the discovery right.
Yeah. Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break. You're listening to KFAR Radio. We're at 907-458-TALK, 907-458-8255, if you want to call in.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
This is the Sean Hannity Show.
I got to tell you something. There are other internet sites that have more credibility than the mainstream media. And BuzzFeed, all BuzzFeed did was feed the fantasy, the hopes, the inner desires, the dreams, the giddiness of the news media in this country to get Trump. How many times? This is it. We got him. Got him. This is it.
Sean Hannity, weekdays on KFAR.
It's time for the Valdez Fishing Report. Interviews, derby standings, tips, and advice for Prince William Sound. We're here with Justin Prox. Halibut fishing season underway, and of course the Derby has started. A lot of big fish coming in, but sometimes people are surprised at the other fish that they can pick up on a halibut charter. So run through some of the other fish that are available here in Prince William Sound, and of course there are some dates to be wary of.
Yeah. So the ones with dates are lingcod and yellow eye. You can only retain those after July 1st. But once you're after July 1st, life is good. Yellow eye have to be, I mean, they're just the big orange fish with a yellow eye. And then
great for fish tacos.
Great for fish tacos, an awesome tasting fish. And then you only want to retain the bigger lingcod. There's a size limit on that to check. But you do, you know, those are good eating fish as well. And then black and dusky rockfish. Rockfish are kind of different. You can keep three rockfish, only one of which may be non-pelagic. Really non-pelagic means colorful. It's about their habitat and where they live, but that changes how they look. So you can retain up to one colorful rockfish and three rockfish a day. The non-colorful ones you find on rocky outcroppings, things like that, steep spires in the water.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Sure, the fishing is great in Valdez, but we also have opportunities to get outside and explore. Enjoy unbelievable views on one of our many hiking trails. Kayak the Sound, book a glacier tour, or learn about Valdez's rich history at one of our many museums. Stop by our visitor center on Fairbanks Drive for advice on everything Valdez. Discover more at valdezalaska.org.
KVAK's Valdez Fishing Report. Fish Valdez and reel in a big one.
KFAR weather.
Cloudy skies expected this afternoon with a chance for scattered thunderstorms. High temperatures reach up to 67. Winds out of the south around 5 miles an hour. Slight chance for isolated rain showers tonight. Lows dip down to about 50. Mainly cloudy skies expected. That's your weather on KFAR, 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Eric Height.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. I have Nick Nugent in the studio here with me, and we are going over the mining districts, a history of the mining districts in Ruby, the Inoko, Iditarod, a little bit of everything out there in western Alaska.
It's a lot further away than we realize sometimes.
Yeah.
And but like we'd talked about with things being south of us, you really don't always think of the fact that the Yukon makes quite an amazing curve, and it starts south of us and ends quite south of us. Well, when the partners were going along, they made it to a point where water levels stopped them about 8 miles below the town site of Iditarod, and they called that it became known as Discoverer's Cabin. Their boat had their steamer had an interesting story. Group of prospectors had arrived on the Inoko from Holy Cross. Those prospectors were ready to sell the boat because it turns out they were wanted by federal authorities for transportation of passenger and liquor without a license. So they had a discount boat on their hands. As things froze up, they sled it across the hills to Otter Creek at a point about 12 miles above its mouth, midwinter. They chose a prospect location rather haphazardly, but it absolutely worked out. They found gold in several holes at a depth of only 12 feet on Christmas Day, 1908.
Now, you know, what's Christmas Day like in weather? Yeah. And here they are out there on Christmas Day.
And not even digging deep enough to be down where the ground's warm.
Yeah.
Or warmer.
Yeah. I mean, they just don't make them like they used to.
No, you had to be tough to do well. Beaton noted that it was their 27th shaft that they had sunk in the hard frozen ground at Iditarod. They then located a number of claims on a mile-long stretch for themselves and friends with power of attorney. They were nearly alone. Traveled routes and settlements were distant. Word of the strike spread slowly, and it was actually well into the summer of 1909.
You know, that's what gets me. Everyone talks about the great discoveries that the British Museum or, you know, the different going through Africa or South America. And here, this is just over a little bit over a century ago, and they're finally starting to get a look at the area by miners, as explorers, by miners. And people wonder why Alaska has such an affinity to the mining associations. This is why. They went out and discovered the areas.
Yeah, if it hadn't been for the prospectors looking around, there would be a lot of areas we would have had little or no interest in, and I kind of wonder if we didn't have the amount of gold and interest if we'd ever become a state.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, by the end of the summer of 1909, most of Otter Creek and its tributaries were claimed. Very little mining occurred that year, though, due to the lack of equipment and supplies. Most of the effort that people were expending were obtaining the needed items to be able to winter over. The vast majority of goods shipped never arrived because the Iditarod was exceptionally low that year and navigation was closed early by ice in the autumn. In spite of that, there was prospecting through the winter of 1909 and 10. This time, the reports were sent out by somebody in the most optimistic form possible and further magnified by the lack of other news to report. The result was, when navigation opened in May of 1910, upward of 2,000 people and considerable supplies and machinery were all bound for the Iditarod strikes. This resulted in the Iditarod Gold Rush, which is still called Alaska's Major Rush, though gold did continue to be found in many other areas afterward. River traffic took till mid-July to sort out. The total gold production for that area for 1910 alone was $825,000. So with all the problems, it was still more than 2 years' production in some of the original strikes on the Innoko. It made Iditarod one of the more important mining areas in Alaska. Their discovery became the third most important placer mining area in the territory, only exceeded by Nome and Fairbanks. It's estimated the gold rush into Iditarod brought from 4,000 to as many as 10,000 stampeders to the mining towns such as Ruby, Iditarod, and Flat. In the next two decades, $30 million in gold was dug from these fields. The interior camps at Iditarod and Ruby were isolated. The majority of stampeders used the river system only from May to October, traveling by steamboats up the Yukon and the other rivers. And the need for winter transportation led to the Alaska Road Commission eventually improving some of the trails.
You know, if you take $30 million and you divide that by $18 an ounce, you're getting 1.675 million ounces of gold out of there. That's pretty good.
It absolutely is. And some of the earliest mines were, from what I have read, were only 10 to 15% efficient. So they were getting such a small amount of gold. That's why some of these areas were mined three and four times as better technology became available.
Yeah.
Well, Beaton went back to Nova Scotia, married a woman named Florence McLennan. They returned to Iditarod, and his business interests there led to his becoming a very wealthy man. With other partners, he operated a dredge on Black Creek successfully during the 1916 and 17 seasons. 1918, tragedy struck the family. His wife and two children were lost on the Princess Sophia. The children were never found. And in the early 1920s then, Beaton met Mary McDonald in Boston, found out she was from near his home in Nova Scotia. They were married in February of 1924 and almost a year later had a son. Well, in the later 1930s then, Beaton sold his dredge interest to his manager, Alex Matheson. The returns were declining, but Matheson hid knowledge of better ground on the claims and later made a fortune moving into that ground. Also about this time, Beaton partnered with Arthur Schonbeck, a pretty prominent merchant from Anchorage. They were dredging Gaines Creek near the original discovery, and that mine was closed during World War II as non-essential. In 1945, Beaton and Schonbeck returned to see if the operation could be restarted. While traveling in a truck driven by Schonbeck, Schonbeck suffered a heart attack, swerved into a river, and unfortunately both men drown.
Oh, boy.
And Beaton, though, was actually...
That's how dangerous it was out there, though.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
Things could go wrong pretty quickly. Beaton and family were some of the first friends of the Miskovich family, and they had a lot of interaction together, and we can get back to that in a bit. Another Scot enters the story, Thomas P. Aiken. In spring of 1897, he followed the news to Dawson ahead of the main stampede, placer mined in the Klondike District till about 1902. He was sometimes associated with his three brothers. In 1901, the Alaska Yukon Directory lists Thomas P. Aiken as a mine operator. In 1903, he came to Fairbanks. He mined on Cleary Creek. There, he met Frank G. Manley, who owned some of the richest claims on Cleary. Aitken leased ground from Manley on Cleary Creek during 1905 and 6, and that was the beginning of their long association. And in 1907, with profits accumulated, Aitken moved into the newly discovered Hot Springs District.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break. I approve this bumper music that they pulled out from where, I don't know, but it's Aerosmith. Walk This Way. Then we got some Fox News, some state news, some commercials and weather. But here's a little bit of elevator bumper music from Aerosmith.
Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
A man in his 20s has been shot and killed in Biddeford, Maine by an ICE agent. According to Maine Independent Senator Angus King, who spoke to the Boston Globe, Senator King says this man had been given an order to leave the country and weaponize his vehicle when he was shot. He went on to the senator to call for a full and transparent investigation. The death of South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham over the weekend is raising questions about whether the Senate will be able to pass President Trump's agenda ahead of the midterm elections, especially a package of strict voter regulations known as the Save America Act. Senate Majority Leader John Thune on Fox.
Well, eventually we'll figure that out. We've got to move forward. You know, obviously right now we are all in the process of still processing and mourning.
This bill restrictions on how Americans can vote and require voters to submit documents to prove citizenship. America is listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
Alaska's news source reports a Wasilla man is dead after he was involved in a pursuit and crash, which came after a report of domestic violence, according to Alaska State Troopers. A 911 call reporting a domestic violence incident at a home in Wasilla came in Saturday around 6:30 p.m., troopers said. The caller reported that Cecil Nelson, age 57, of Wasilla, entered the residence without permission, assaulted the caller, and refused to leave, according to troopers. It was reported to troopers that Nelson was intoxicated and left before officers arrived. When troopers found Nelson's car, they tried to stop him, but Nelson refused to stop and led troopers on a short pursuit. During the pursuit, Nelson reached speeds of approximately 100 miles per hour and passed traffic using the oncoming lane, causing a significant risk to the public. Nelson lost control of the vehicle on a curve and went off the road at a high rate of speed. He was not wearing a seatbelt and was thrown from the vehicle. Despite life-saving efforts, troopers said Nelson died at the scene. An investigation
streaming
is underway.
Live online at KFAR660.com.
The U.S. Coast Guard is on the front lines protecting Alaska's waters and communities. From search and rescue missions to protecting and monitoring marine fisheries, the Coast Guard and its mission is vital to our Alaska way of life. And Senator Dan S. Sullivan is leading the charge to deliver the resources our Coast Guard needs to get the job done. That's why Senator Dan S. Sullivan helped secure $25 billion in investments for the Coast Guard, the largest Coast Guard investment in history. That means new icebreakers for Alaska, more housing for Coast Guard families, and critical updates to infrastructure all across Alaska. Call Senator Dan S. Sullivan at 907-271-5915. And thank him for securing big investments in our Coast Guard and delivering for Alaska. Paid for by Last Frontier Action. LastFrontierAction.com.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. With small ships that bring travelers closer to the destination, there's more time to explore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the FIFA World Cup to competitive business environments, grand ambitions lead to game-changing achievements. At Bank of America, we're there to support businesses at every step, providing insights and expertise to help you gain an edge.
He shoots! He scores!
What would you like the power to do? Explore winning business solutions at bofa.com/gamechangers. Bank of America, official bank of the FIFA World Cup 2026.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. I have Nick Nugent in the studio with me. We're looking at the Ruby and Oko and Iditarod mining districts and some of the characters who explored that area.
They were They were later in terms of that being the last big rush, but certainly what they had to go through, and I think their distance away from supply centers made it no less hard than a lot of the earlier mining
efforts. Oh, yeah.
Well, Aitken and his partners.
Oh, phone call real quick?
Sure.
Good morning. You're on KFAR Radio, and your name is?
Hey, it's Charles, Dave.
Hello, Charles.
I got a story about Lieutenant Kastner and Lieutenant Heron. Kastner up the Copper and Heron up the Susitna, 1899, working for a Glenn, an army. They both almost starved and were saved by local people. Up the Kastner up the Salta and Heron from Tulida villagers.
Okay.
And those two, and fed them. Ed Heron's crew for 2 months before they could get out. They all lost their mules and everything. They had nothing left to. They tried using horses, and they were heading to that country you're talking about.
Okay.
Country. Okay.
Thanks, Charles. Appreciate it. You have a great day, buddy.
Things changed in 1911. Changed the nature of mining on Flat Creek, certainly.
Well, actually, Charles brings up a good subject. Horses,
yes,
out in that area probably didn't last long.
Horses were particularly prone to not having enough nutrition from the grasses available.
Exactly. Starved to death.
Yeah, mules seemed to have been a better deal, although for whatever reason, they weren't as prevalent.
I know.
I guess people thought they looked bad riding a mule.
Or veterinary sciences weren't into.
That's certainly true, too.
But good thought there, Charles. Thank you.
Well, in 1911, Aitken's mine was the largest producer. It was one of the largest mechanized mines in Alaska. Capital change that year? The Guggenheims arrived, headed by a syndicate headed by F.W. Copeland and A.E. Austin, came to Flat. Aitken sold his share of the Marietta Association to the Googies for $1.5 million. That's a pretty good turn.
What year was that?
That was 1911.
Wowza.
That's we were just talking about the price of gold in
versus now, yeah.
I think if I'd have to figure that gold was knee-deep sitting on top of the ground in those days.
Wow.
And Aitken set to work, though, and acquired most of Lower Flat Creek for the Googies. In the spring of 1912, the Yukon Gold Company, operator of the Guggenheim gold mining operations in the Klondike, brought in a 6-cubic-foot bucket line stacker dredge, and they were mining out there. The dredge was first positioned on the Marietta Association, where it mined some of the richest ground ever mined by a gold dredge in Alaska. On April 3, 1912, Aitken married Chicago socialite, artist, and silent movie Beryl C. Boughton. In New York, newspapers had banner headlines that Boughton was going to Alaska. She found out a little bit more about Flat, never came. Their marriage was short and described by a few sources as messy.
Ooh.
So not an easy divorce.
No.
Aitken came back north. The Iditarod pioneer followed his every move. His splashy marriage and divorce sold newspapers, and did his association with the Guggenheims. He was traveling to his winter home and gave a interview to that newspaper, and it's worth taking a look at. It's available online. He did a lot of talking about the need for transportation, and he certainly laid out what needed done in the area. Well, they then... they were looking at the state begin to get involved. I'm sorry, the territory, the Alaska Road Commission began to get involved and started to build up the Iditarod Trail, which, of course, as we know, actually starts in Seward and comes all the way through. Aitken turned his attention to properties out of the Iditarod area and was quite heavily involved with silver mines at Keno and in Mayo in the Yukon. By 1919, he was involved in lode mining. Aitken probably started more mining properties and got them going than any other prospector or mine promoter that was ever, certainly in Alaska and a lot of the rest of the U.S. Well, got a little piece that there's a self-published manuscript, Trails and Tailings, an Alaskan autobiography by Elmer Frank Katuri. His story is one of many other miners, those who came to Alaska for economic opportunity, not household names, but they were miners with successes as well as failures. And he talks a little bit about how he got here. His father's sister and her husband had gone to Flat City, and in 1913, Katui was living in Butte, Montana, and the gold deposits were picking up. So his father, brother, and wife and daughter also went from Butte, and they came up to do some mining. And he's got some interesting outlooks. But one of the things he tells us was they were on the way up, they ended up flying with a couple of pilots who were on their, on the train with a couple of the pilots who were on their way to Fairbanks. It says, the train was waiting for us at Seward. And this is out of his transcript. It said, before we reached Anchorage, Frank Dorbent tried to talk us into getting off there and letting him fly us to Flat City. The airplane fare was $350 per person. We refused because Oscar said we had plenty of time. Meals and lodging would only be $65 each over the trail. Oscar and I got off at Nenana, and they ended up walking to Iditarod.
Wow.
But if you think about $350 in 1913, that's probably about the same amount it cost us to go to London a couple of years ago. Well, the trails were well packed. They were built up about 3 feet wide. Government maintained the road and manned roadhouses. They were approximately 25 miles apart. And the charge was $4.50 a night, which included supper, breakfast, a bunk, and blankets. There were a few relief cabins that didn't have a caretaker, so they were just shelters. What they'd do is they would buy food at the last opportunity and carry it with them. They made it to McGrath, and that was as far up the Kuskokwim as the river freighting barges could navigate. It had a landing field, very large Northern Commercial Company general store at that time, and another store. And he mentions, we could have cut off 50 miles if there had been a trail broken to Flat, but the mail trail went via Tacotna and Ophir. So that shows you some of the problems. It wasn't a direct straight line to about anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on the 17th day on the trail, they came to Iditarod. 1912, he talks about it then. There had been 3,000 people living there for several years at this point. There was a small railroad called the Tramway with rails made from wooden 2x4s with iron strapping over them. That ran from Iditarod to Flat Creek. And he got a job overhauling the dredge. It ran off a large diesel. And he talks about each day one of his jobs was to heat grease to have fresh grease to pour and be the oiler on the dredge. The trommel screen would make a metallic clicking sound, and Elmer would rush down, and he knew that the bucket line had brought up a hammer, pick, wrench, or something that people had lost. He'd rush down, pull it off the conveyor belt, clean it up, and save money on buying tools.
So, hey, you did what you had to do.
It's just an interesting story the way things worked out.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break. You're listening to KFAR Radio. We'll be back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
If you want to show off that summer smile, it all starts with a visit to Affordable Dental Care. And like the name says, yep, it's affordable. And nowadays, few things are more important than saving money. Affordable Dental Care does both. In a warm, friendly atmosphere, it's the perfect dental clinic for the entire family. From cleanings to crowns, they got you covered. That's Affordable Dental Care. See all of their services online at adcak.com. Affordable Dental Care, just off 14th Avenue right downtown.
KFAR Radio is proud to bring you 50-50 Friday. Every Friday at 9 a.m., log on to our website for a half-price offer from a local business. Great deals on restaurants, stores, shops, services, sporting events, and more. It's 50-50 Friday. This week's offer?
It's the Alaska Axe Throwing Company off Van Horn Road. Full axe throwing lanes available for individuals, groups, or parties. Throw everything from axes and knives to spears and other items. Plus a full rage room to blow off steam by smashing stuff. They even have a portable axe throwing trailer for your next party or event. This week, get a $50 gift certificate for half price. Good for throwing axes, the rage room, merchandise, and even beverages. It's this week's 50-50 Friday offer.
So log on to KFARradio.com this Friday morning starting at 9 a.m. for this awesome half price offer. But hurry, as this deal will go fast. It's 50-50 Friday from KFAR.
Last winter was so long and cold. I don't know if I can take another one like that.
Care for your home this summer with help from the Woodway.
But Radio Man seems overwhelming and I don't know where to start.
Start your journey toward putting safe fire inside your house at the Woodway.
What if I want a gas fireplace and not a wood stove?
You're in luck. Woodway has heating appliances for wood, pellet, gas, and heating oil. It's your one-stop shop for heating needs.
Thanks, Radio Man.
Check out rebates in July from Hearthstone and Toyotomi at the Woodway in College Road.
KFAR weather.
Chance for scattered thunderstorms this afternoon. Otherwise, cloudy skies expected. Daytime highs approaching 67. South winds around 5 miles per hour. Slight chance of rain. Tonight, lows level off around 50. Mainly cloudy skies expected. Daytime highs approaching 70 tomorrow. Overcast skies. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Paul Trombley.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back in the studio with Nick Nugent. And as I often say, it's a discussion you don't hear during our commercial breaks that are the most interesting. Nick, what did you think about my phone call during that commercial break?
I just thought somebody had made you a bad offer on one of your properties.
It's my neighbor. My wonderful neighbor, and we went the whole gamut of, you know, F off, coming over for Sunday dinner, your dog, my dog, oh my God. You know, so you couldn't hear what he was saying, but your eyes were getting big. We have many terms of endearment.
I can understand that.
Anyway.
Well, it's worth going to the library. I believe they have a copy of Elmer Katturi's manuscript. And you can read it in about 3 hours. It's worth just perusing and reading some of the more enjoyable parts. They brought their equipment in at the beginning of World War II. It took 29 days to bring their D-8s in from Flat to Nenana, most of it around 50 below. So again, another pretty Herculean effort by our standards of later. We shouldn't get on. I think we'll spend the rest of our time here with some of the Miskoviches.
Okay.
They have an amazing association with the Iditarod country. David Strandberg was a Swedish miner, and he had the not uncommon path of Klondike to Fairbanks and on to Flat. He was very well respected by many and did well in his mining activities. He was very good at logistics and early on saw the value of the airplane in the remote camps. In 1938, he actually acquired an interest in Star Airlines, which was part of the lineage of Alaska Airlines. In 1919, Strandberg gave Peter Miskovich a break when Peter proposed a lease of water from Strandberg rather from the Guggenheims. And Peter's letter is wonderful. He wrote it phonetically, and so you have a Croatian writing phonetically to a Swede, and they come up with this wonderful agreement together. Must have been quite something to see. Well, Miskovich, though, was able to get a very good cut out of the mining property prior to the Guggenheims reneging on a promised lease. Once they saw how good Miskovich was doing, they decided not to give him the lease. Miskovich went on then to establish his own mining empire. He had come from what is now Croatia, to underground mines in Montana, coal mine in Washington State. He headed for Alaska after reading of a new rush in Alaska, made his way to Flat, and his first job was woodcutting for $6 a cord. He took a position as a construction foreman on the tramway, and he found the Hensley fraction at Discovery. He was married in 1912. He and Slana had their first child, son George, in April 1915. Peter began experimentation with steam and hydraulics. One invention was a steam washing machine, which is now in the possession of the Pioneers of Alaska here in town. They're looking for a way to get it displayed. And in the late...
What year was Peter born?
Peter was born... Well, he came to the U.S. in 1903. I missed his birth year.
Okay. I'm going to insert a little story here.
Okay.
I met a Peter Miskovich, who was my age. I met him at Cal Poly in the dorms. You know, everyone's, you know, your first week, where are you all from? And everyone's introducing themselves, and we're in some dorm room, whatever, with people. And I said, I'm from Fairbanks, Alaska. And this voice came out, Fairbanks. And Peter Miskovich. And I think it was the third. Okay. You know, his dad was the second. And, you know, mining out in Flat. And then I go to my first tennis class. And there's Peter Miskovich. So we became friends after that. He went to a different school afterwards. But very, very highly intelligent engineer. Highly intelligent. So I think the DNA pool kept going.
It really seems to have, when you look at some of the information the Mining Hall of Fame has,
yeah.
Even those Miskoviches without formal training seem to be very good at mechanical.
And then he told me about the inventions of his family, and they had houses down in, you know, very affluent areas of L.A.
Well, there were... rumors that the Guggenheims were 23, the Miskovich family had no association or arrangements with the Guggenheims any longer, and they returned to Discovery. Most of that area, because it was flat, it was aptly named, used hydraulic lifts, which could raise gravel by about 15 feet, allowing adequate slope for a sluice. Peter designed his own lift, built it in a small blacksmith shop. That year, in a shortened season, he extracted 400 ounces. An adjacent claim was sold to Martin Rosslyn, who in turn sold to Peter. Much of this ground had been mined prior, but Peter reasoned heavier equipment could reach untouched deposits, so he started with a Cat 50, the first in the district, and helped by the higher gold prices, he increased production from 8,000 to 60,000 off that claim. 1936 to World War II were probably their best years. Peter innovated with equipment. He built a hydroelectric plant, increasing production to thousands of ounces per year and mining efficiency from just 10 to 30%. Because of the hydroelectric, he wasn't using gas and diesel fuel, so the War Board did not shut him down. He wasn't using valuable war supplies, so he and some miners too old for the draft continued to mine till eventually his health failed. So John Arthur Miskovich was one of Peter's and Stana's seven children. He was born in 1918. All the children were exposed to mining from birth. John, on July 23rd, 1933, witnessed Wiley Post crash land. And during his around-the-world trip, the Flat miners helped Post get the Winnie Mae back in the air. John worked for the family mine. A valuable lesson was how to treat employees. Their operation did not bar anyone who would come and work. They paid $7 for a 10-hour shift when most mines only offered $4.50 to $5.50. They had loyal employees who worked well for them. When World War II hit, John served in the 807th Engineering Battalion in the Aleutians. And during the late 1940s and 50s, Peter Miskovich and Sons, which was the name of their operation, began to expand mining activities from their Flat Iditarod home base. Peter passed in 1950. His four sons took over the mining operations. They had placer mines in Poorman and Flat Creeks in the Ruby District. Those were the first to be mined by the firm for gold outside of their Iditarod district home. The economics of the 1950s made profitable mining harder. The company was divided to be able to better react to changing conditions. In 1958, John bought the Otter Creek Dredging Company and operated that dredge till 1966, when unfortunately a fire destroyed the repair facility. When gold prices were floated by the Nixon administration, John was able to successfully mine near the original discovery claim through the 1980s. Miskovich has pioneered many hydraulic mining technologies and held more than 300 U.S. and foreign patents for his innovations. He's best known for the 1946 IntelliGiant, sometimes known as the Misco Giant. It's a high-powered automatic hydraulic monitor, and he was working on it while he was still in the Army. That device now, when you see fireboats in New York City blowing water 100 feet in the air, they are using Miskovich's device for the nozzle. Well, John contributed to an awful lot of the written history of the area, filling in the story of many of the miners. John and wife Mary made their last trip to Flat in 2012, and that ends quite a segment of Alaska mining history, and I think that's a good place to start because... Oh, yeah. Well, we could go again.
Oh, I thought you said start.
I did.
Okay. Good place to start. Oh.
We can run through it again.
No, that's okay.
Okay. We got things to do. But I think it's interesting that the Miskoviches were there early, and they were some of the last people there. And through a lot of their own ingenuity and hard work, they were able to continue in an area that people probably would have thought, that's got to be mined out.
True. Oh, that was good, man. And you ended up with the Miskoviches, who some I knew and grew up with. What the heck? What are you thinking about in August?
Well, in August, we'll have Libby Dalton come and give us the second part on her father. And then I'll probably be off in September, and we'll start trying remotely in October.
You got it. Appreciate this. What the heck? You got any fun plans for the week? Aren't you the exalted person in the parade of the pioneers?
Well, I've been asked to be the grand marshal of the parade. So
you accepted?
I did. I suppose I need to find YouTube and get some pictures of the queen and see how to wave. You know, she had that little hand gesture, so she didn't wear her whole arm out. And then I'll be...
You're thinking too much of yourself.
Yeah, well, very likely.
You got two hands. Wave with one, rest. Wave with the other, rest.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Put a bag of candy in, and every once in a while, throw a handful out.
When is the parade? Saturday?
It'll be Saturday the 25th, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Mug up 26th. Friday the 24th.
Yes.
And then the Pedro Monument dedication the 26th on Sunday.
Yes. And Jerry Cleworth is going to be the speaker there. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, sir. Fairbanks, that is our show for today. I hope you enjoyed it. You have a great day. I don't have any guests scheduled for tomorrow yet, but you never know. I'll see you tomorrow.